Imagine, if you will, a podcast. A podcast journeying beyond that which is known to man. It exists in both fandom and discovery, in viewing and critiquing. My name is Matt Hurt. Welcome to Anthology. Hello, and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. If this is your first time listening, Anthology is a podcast exploring science fiction anthology storytelling during television's golden age, beginning with The Twilight Zone. Each podcast, I take two episodes of the show, give a summary of the plot, share notable cast and crew trivia, and then delve into my feelings on the episode as a viewer. You can find more of Anthology at AnthologyPod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, send an email to Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com, contact me on Facebook at facebook.com/anthologypod, or, of course, you can call and leave me a voicemail at 317-762-6099. Today on the show, I'll be discussing episodes 5 and 6 of season 1 of The Twilight Zone. These episodes are Walking Distance and Escape Clause. Both episodes are about people displeased with their life and seeking happiness in very different and very strange places, of course, in The Twilight Zone. Without further ado, let's get to talking about these episodes, shall we? So the first episode this week is Walking Distance. It aired October 30th, 1959, and it's one that I'm pretty excited to talk about. As always, here's an episode summary. I will be spoiling it, so if you haven't seen it yet and you don't want to be spoiled, go check it out on Netflix or Hulu and come back. Martin Sloan is a 36-year-old vice president of an ad agency in New York. When the pressures of his job get the better of him, he drives to escape his troubles. After stopping to get his car serviced, Martin notices a sign for Homewood, his hometown only a mile and a half away, walking distance. Martin walks to town and finds everything exactly as he remembers it. Nothing has changed because he's walked back into 1934 and soon finds his parents and his 11-year-old self. Desperate to warn his young self to savor his childhood, he inadvertently causes young Marty to break his leg. When Martin's father finds him to return the time traveler's wallet and tell him he knows who he is, Martin's father tells him he can't stay. Martin realizes that his father is right and heads back to his life. So as usual, I'm going to start by breaking down the cast and the crew of the episode, but I should warn you that this, the behind the scenes of this episode are a little troubling and a little depressing, I guess. So it stars Gig Young. He was born with the name Byron Barr, and he developed a love of theater in high school, which led to being accepted into the acclaimed Pasadena Community Playhouse. While he was in a play called Pancho, he and his castmate George Reeves were spotted by a Warner Brothers talent scout and signed supporting player contracts with the studio. In 1942, he was cast as a character named Gig Young in the movie The Gay Sisters. Since there was already an actor named Byron Barr, he actually just adopted the name Gig Young as his stage name, which it's kind of – that's something interesting. I've never known of anyone ever to do that. The Gay Sisters actually boosted his career quite a bit, but his career was really postponed because of the war. He served in the Coast Guard for 3 years in the Pacific, and after he came back from the war, he actually continued acting and started landing like leading man adjacent roles. What I mean by that is like kind of second build characters, supporting characters, stuff like that. In 1951, he was nominated for a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for a role in a movie called Come Fill the Cup. 7 years later, he also got another Best Supporting Actor nod for a comedic turn in the movie Teacher's Pet. He worked prolifically in television alongside his film career, hence this role in Twilight Zone. And then finally, in 1969, he won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his role in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Unfortunately, and this is where it gets a little dark, I guess, he was an alcoholic. He had a string of marriages. He was married 5 times from 1940 until his death in 1978. 3 weeks after marrying his 5th wife, Kim Schmidt, he shot her to death and then committed suicide. In his will, he left his Oscar to his agent, Martin Balm. The Oscar was found beside the two bodies. Martin Balm said that Gig knew real pain at his memorial service. So it's a tragic end for someone who I don't know any of his other work or anything. I haven't seen anything else he's been in. But he did a really good job performing in this episode of The Twilight Zone. And it sounds like he had a lot of demons. Co-starring as Martin's father, Robert, in this episode is Frank Overton. He was a character actor who worked a lot in the 50s and 60s in television. He kind of had a specialty for authoritative characters. He played Sheriff Heck Tate in To Kill a Mockingbird, and he played a general in Failsafe. He went on to appear in another episode of The Twilight Zone in 1963 called Mute. We'll get to that eventually. He passed away from a heart attack in 1967 at the age of 49. Also appearing in this episode is Ron Howard, credited as Ronnie Howard. This was about a year before the Andy Griffith Show premiered, what I noticed from it, from his IMDb, is that he worked a lot. He worked so much in that year, basically, making a lot of appearances on different television shows. And here he just plays a kid in the neighborhood. And, you know, it's maybe he's only got a couple lines and everything. But it's worth mentioning. I have an anecdote about this, is that one of the books that I'm using as a reference material for this podcast is The Twilight Zone Companion, which I actually wrote a review of it on obsessivebooknerd.com. And it's funny because this book was written in, like, I think, like, the early 80s, I think. And I'm reading the second edition of it, which was updated about seven or 8 years after it was published. But anyway, for this episode, it references Ronnie Howard of Happy Days fame, and I thought that was pretty funny because obviously he's a very noteworthy director. Obviously, he's a very famous director now, and he probably has one of the greatest transitions from child actor to an adulthood Hollywood career. S's and G's. My favorite movie that he's directed is probably Apollo 13. Although, you know, Rush was a really good one that was recent. Although I wouldn't say that it's good enough to be like one of my favorites, but I think that it was a really solid movie. And also, I haven't seen these two in a while, but I really feel like Frost Nixon and Cinderella Man are kind of underappreciated. And I also have a soft spot for Backdraft from, like, I think it was like 93, with Kurt Russell and one of the Baldwins. I want to say Stephen Baldwin or maybe William Baldwin, Billy Baldwin. I don't know. But anyway, Backdraft. I think Scott Glenn was also in this movie. But that was one of those movies that I was, like, really young, way too young to watch it. And I just watched it all the time, like a VHS copy of it. And I really enjoyed it. Anyway, so as I said, Walking Distance was an early role for him. A year later, with a ton of credits in between, the Andy Griffith Show started. And obviously, you know, he would go on to do American Graffiti and do a very, very prestigious directing career. He was also in the running or one of the people that was developing an adaptation of Stephen King's The Dark Tower a few years ago. And that fell through for him, but I think he's still producing the one that they're currently in talks of doing at Sony. So I don't know if it'll happen, but I have bought the domain name, thedarktowerpodcast.com, because I know that if that ever happens, I'm going to want a podcast about it. So stay tuned for that. Writer for this episode is, of course, Rod Serling, as he wrote most of the other episodes. This episode takes a pretty negative view of executives, at least from my perspective. It's kind of this kind of, you know, the whole story of this episode is that this businessman is upset over, you know, his life as a businessman and seeks to reclaim his youth or to really tap into his nostalgia as a cathartic experience by going back to his hometown. He wants to go home again because he can't handle the stress and the pressure of his prestigious and successful job as an ad executive. And I feel like that's a very negative that's a very negative look at kind of the businessman stereotype, I guess. I don't know if that was intentional on Rod Serling's part or not, but I think that's something worth mentioning. Also, this is a really poignant story about a man who he wants to flee his adult life and recapture what made his youth so special. And I feel like Serling wrote this when he was about 35 years old, right when he was becoming one of the most successful writers in show business. It was actually probably a couple years after he became a more noteworthy presence in the Hollywood writing scene, I guess. So I don't know if he used walking distance as an escapist fantasy in his more doubtful moments or not, but I could see this script being a cathartic reminder to leave the past behind and to really kind of keep a perspective on his present and his future and not get too wrapped up into all of the pressures of his job. I could definitely see that. That's just conjecture on my part. I have no idea if Serling wrote it with that intention or not, but I think that there could be an interesting correlation there. And finally, the director for this episode is Robert Stevens, who directed Where Is Everybody, the pilot episode of The Twilight Zone. After this, he didn't direct any more episodes, but he was a very prolific director in the 50s and 60s, and in particular in television. He directed a lot of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I think it was something like 44 episodes of that show, plus several episodes of the spinoff show or the continuation of that show. I think the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, I think that's what it's called. I didn't write in my notes. I apologize. And he's the only director from Hitchcock's two shows to win an Emmy for his work on that. So that's, you know, I really liked his direction and Where Is Everybody? And I'll talk more about his work in this episode in particular, but I could definitely see that because he's very talented at you know, telling the story. But after 1970, he worked a lot less, and this is where it gets a little dark here. Also, he died of a heart attack after he was beaten and robbed in a home invasion in Connecticut. I think this was in the mid-80s. The Associated Press mistakenly referred to him as a television writer after his death. And, you know, that's just such a bummer to see someone who worked so much. And I only have two episodes of television to really gauge my opinion of his work. But judging from these two episodes of The Twilight Zone, he was a very talented director. And it's kind of a shame to see or to know that his work, I guess, went unappreciated or maybe not unnoticed, but just not that he didn't garner the kind of reception after his death that I feel like his talent necessitated, I guess. So we've come to my feelings as a viewer on this episode. And I mentioned last week that I would have a lot to say about this episode because I love time travel, and I really do. I guess it's somewhat worth mentioning that this episode is credited as, J.J. Abrams has said that this is his favorite episode of The Twilight Zone. But anyway, I can definitely see that because this is such a great mind-bending, I don't even know if I would say mind-bending, but it's a really strong, strong emotional episode that's tied to this very straightforward time travel premise. And I really love the way that Robert Stevens used mirrors to create the time travel effect. Martin gets out of his car at the service station. He goes to the cigarette machine, and that's when he notices the sign that Homewood is nearby. So he tells the serviceman that he's going to go walk to this town. So the camera just zooms in on the mirror of the cigarette machine, and he walks off to Homewood, and then it kind of just – there's a slow dissolve to where it just fades to black and then comes back to The next scene that takes place in a soda shop when has Martin walking into the soda shop in 1934. And that's it's a very bare bones way of introducing time travel into an episode. There isn't some big effects heavy device or any kind of flashes or anything like that. It's just a straightforward dissolve. And I think that really, really does well. It's well suited given that the episode has such a strong character focus on Martin and his inability to divorce himself from the nostalgia of his past and how his greed makes him want to be a part of the past or wants to reclaim his past or anything like that. And then this is also mimicked later in the episode when he time travels back to 1959 because it just kind of – he jumps up on the – on the merry-go-round, and as it's spinning around, the camera dissolves and goes to a scene of the soda shop again, but it's zoomed in or it's focused on the spinning record of the jukebox. And I think that's just – I really appreciated that way of signaling to the audience that the changes happen without making a big show of it and keeping the episode and the story grounded in Martin's story. As I said, Martin's a greedy character, somewhat. Although it's interesting because he starts off being just really, really agitated and very, very kind of belligerent to the service to the gas station attendant, and you know he kind of follows the pattern, I should say, of these Twilight Zone characters being kind of ordinary people or relatable people, because he's belligerent to the gas station attendant, but then when he realizes that – or like after a moment, he apologizes to him. He's like, yeah, sorry. And then when he walks off to the to Homewood, when he gets there, there's a kind of sense of instant catharsis where he just walks in and he's just super chipper, super happy. And I think that's part of it, is that it's a way to signal to the audience that he is a character that we can get behind, even though that he was very agitated earlier in the episode. But when he realizes he's time traveled, he wants more. He wants to make sure that he knows he tells his young self to savor his youth and really appreciate it. And it's, you know, maybe I misspoke, and he's not necessarily greedy so much as trapped by his present. He doesn't see the cotton candy and carousels and band concerts and stuff like that in his adult life. And I guess where the greediness comes in is that he wants to reclaim his youth. He wants to take his youth. He doesn't want to just be nostalgic for his past. He wants to relive his past, and that's what drives him to go after young Martin, to tell him to savor his youth and to really appreciate it and everything like that, even though it comes with disastrous consequences. What I really liked about the way that the story develops in this episode, however, is that when Martin sees his young self carving his name on the gazebo thing, that isn't enough to convince him that he's time traveled, even though he literally sees himself and recognizes himself and knows himself. It's a very natural reaction that he has to this really just crazy predicament that he's in, is that he doesn't believe it, because it would have been an easy way for him to be convinced instantly that he's time traveled. And in that case, it would be very interesting, or it would have been an easier way to transition into the second act of the episode or the second half of the episode. Instead, he goes to his house and he's offended when his parents don't recognize him. And he's very angry about it. And that causes them to shut the door on his face and everything. And it isn't until he really talks to the neighbor that has the new car that it kind of clicks with him. And in fact, it kind of takes, there's a break in about the middle part of the episode, and then when it comes back, when the episode comes back, there's a mid-episode narration from Serling explaining that he's time-traveled and that he's thought about it and he has a plan in place. He's now resolved to change the past. And this was the first time that Serling had a mid-episode narration, and I think that's more of a way to, I guess, more cleanly transition the episode from the story of a guy trapped in the past to a guy who is in the past and wants to change his present. it's a mixed bag for me because it could have been easier. Like I said, it could have been easier to make him instantly convinced that he's changed, and that he could have a. It goes from cathartic to recognizing that he's in the past, and then it could have just as easily been like, "Oh, I can change my past and all that stuff." Instead, there's this this commercial break in the episode that leads to a shift in the narrative, like everything's changed from day to night to the circumstances of his time travel, or his perception of the time travel, I should say. But I don't have a problem with it at all, actually. I think that it really helps move the narrative along, and it kind of separates the episode into two segments, and the second segment is a much darker or more ominous story being told, and I can appreciate that. Something I noticed toward the end of this episode when Martin goes to the merry-go-round and tries to warn his young self that he's that he needs to cherish his youth and everything is that Robert Stevens, he utilizes slanted angles again. He did the same thing in Where Is Everybody to great effect. I really appreciated that and I really enjoyed that. And that's something that I kind of noticed in these two episodes that he directed. He both uses slanted angles and uses mirrors to great effect. And it kind of makes me curious to check out some of his work in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Because like I said, these are the only two pieces of his work that I have seen. And I kind of wonder if his technique is more more varied in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And that maybe the stories being told in The Twilight Zone just necessitated these two these particular pieces of his talent, because I would think that using slanted angles and mirrors and stuff like that in the 40 to 50 episodes of Alfred Hitchcock shows that he directed, I think that would get a little tiresome. I would hate to think that he was a one-trick pony, because I really appreciated his directing in both of these episodes of The Twilight Zone. So the last 7 minutes of Walking Distance, they are incredibly touching. And it's something that I really, really, really appreciated. And it's one of the more it really tugs at the heartstrings. And it really, really leaves a very strong impression of what the theme of the story is and what the message that the show wants to convey of this. It's there's a dialogue between Martin and his dad that just really hits home to the viewer. Martin's dad comes up to him after young Martin has broken his leg or injured his leg after being chased by our protagonist on the merry-go-round. And so his dad tells him, he says, "Hey, I want to let you know that the kid's all right and that I looked through your wallet and I know that I know who you are and I know that you know things about the future and stuff like that." And so they have this one of the nicest like heart to hearts I've seen on television between a father and son. And in it, Martin's dad tells him that he doesn't belong there. He needs to go back to his world, to his present, and to find the cotton candy and band concerts and carousels and everything. Find that there. Don't try to take the summer away from his youth or to his youthful counterpart. He says that there's maybe the one line of dialogue that really left an impression on me was that he says, maybe there's one summer to every customer and this is his summer and you can't take it or anything like that. It's such a depressing thought, I guess. And it's just sad to me that it really hits home as someone who is personally, I'm close to 30. I'm not an old person. Crap. No, I'm close to 30. And in this episode, Martin is 36. Holy crap. But it's something that resonates with me as someone who I have positive memories of my childhood. And I think that at points when, it's something that harkens back to the universality of this episode or of this series, is that you can really appreciate the way that the everyman characters or the very ordinary characters that are designed to appeal to mass audiences of the late 50s, early 60s, there's a timelessness to it, in that you can really appreciate a character who is wanting a cathartic experience and really wanting to tap into the nostalgia of his youth, because I have positive memories of my childhood. I would love to be a kid again, but I know I can't because I have not mastered time travel yet. And after this episode, I don't know if I would want to. So it's a very touching episode, very strong. This is one of those episodes that I'll go back and revisit as often as I can, or as often as I want to, because this is one of those episodes that I could watch again and again, because it's a very heartfelt episode. It's a very strong, strongly written episode. The narration at the end of the episode, of Serling's closing narration, is very, very poignant and very heartfelt, and what it really conveys a nice message to put a button on the episode, and I really appreciated it. As for historical, cultural context, this is a segment that I should probably rename, because I never really have any historical or cultural context for it. But this is something I thought about when watching it. While working on the pilot episode of this podcast, I gave audio files to some friends, and one of them was Chad from the Secular Perspective podcast, and he mentioned that he was never really a fan of The Twilight Zone, and that he has trouble watching things that that aired before he was born, which is something I can understand. I can understand that if you kind of feel a disconnection with older work, you can't really tap. Some people can't really tap into what it is. But what I found in watching Walking Distance is that this episode takes place in 1934 and 1959, and it could really serve as a good entry point into the series for people who feel like shows and movies that were before their time are hard to get into. It's something that really makes me appreciate these types of time travel stories. Time travel stories of this nature are great time capsules, really. Because they take an established character, or a character that has been established in the present day, in this case 1959, and by throwing them into a nostalgia-fueled story of the past, it somehow makes the present of the episode or of the work timeless, and makes it a period piece in itself. It's more palatable for people who can't really connect with what they view as dated material, because by making the focus of an episode in the past, while also having included pieces of stuff from the present day, it kind of makes for two concurrent period pieces, if that makes any sense. It may be one of the reasons why Back to the Future is so timeless to me, because there's 1985 Hill Valley, and then there's 1955, and there's so much care to creating the past in these types of stories that it makes the present also be as pristine as that, if that makes any sense. I don't know, but these kind of stories take their present day and they make it as much as a period piece as their destination. And I feel like if you have trouble getting into The Twilight Zone, or if you have trouble getting into stories that you may view as dated, I recommend this as a good entry point to the series. So one other thing that's worth noting before I go into my discussion of the episode Escape Clause is that Walking Distance is one of those iconic Twilight Zone episodes, one of the ones that I can appreciate, and one of the things that I've heard about before the Twilight Zone was really on my radar. And as such, there was a comic there. I mean, there's been plenty of comics of the Twilight Zone in the past, but one of the more recent Twilight Zone comic books that have come into being is Shadow and Substance from Dynamite Comics. Their first two issues, was basically a modern-day adaptation of Walking Distance. It was called Stumbling Distance, about this alcoholic writer who goes back to his hometown to for a book signing. And what he does is he goes back and he realizes that he's gone back into his past. And there was a certain edge to this comic. There's basically an effort on his part to he came back to a time in which he was about to do something foolish. I won't spoil what that was, but the motivation of the character in the comic was to prevent this from happening. And it was really enjoyable. It was a really strong first two issues for a comic book. I haven't read any more of Shadow and Substance, but I really liked the artwork, and it opens and closes with narration in the style of Serling. And I don't know, the word choices, the way that it's written, you just hear Rod Serling saying it, and that's something that I really enjoyed. Of course, before I move on to the next episode, here's a highlight from a recent episode of The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast that I host with two of my friends, Mike and Tiny.
Alex Garland shot it really well. I think my issues were with the script and just the direction that the movie went. And again, this is all opinion. I mean, I'm sure there's other people who saw it and really liked it, but I just thought it was... If there was subtext or depth to it, I didn't pick up on it.
Did he write the movie as well?
Yeah, he wrote and directed it. Yeah.
I gotta say, I'm really surprised. Usually we're defending ourselves against Matt, Tiny. We often see eye to eye, often on especially sci-fi flicks.
And of course, you can find The Obsessive Viewer on iTunes, Stitcher, and at obsessiveviewer.com. Okay, next up I have for you Escape Clause. This is episode 6 of Twilight Zone's first season. It was aired November 6th, 1959, and as always, here is an episode summary of the episode. Walter Baedeker is a hypochondriac with severe narcissistic tendencies. He fears something as small as a draft and depends on his wife to care for his psychosomatic ailments despite harboring resentment for other people, including her. One night, Walter is visited by a man named Mr. Cadwallader. He's the devil, and he proposes to Baedeker a deal. In exchange for Walter's soul, Walter will live forever. Nothing will kill him, neither disease nor incident, unless he uses the escape clause wherein Walter can simply call upon the devil to take his life. After collecting insurance claims on numerous incidents that should have killed him, Walter finds his immortality bothersome. The thrill in his life is gone and he's grown bored, so he decides to jump off the roof. When his wife tries to stop him, she falls to her death. This leads Walter to confess to murdering her, thinking that surviving the electric chair will reinvigorate him. Unfortunately for Mr. Baedeker, he's sentenced to life in prison with no parole. When he's locked away, Walter uses the escape clause and dies of a heart attack in his cell. Starring as Walter Baedeker is David Wayne, no relation to the present-day David Wayne, who did Wet Hot American Summer. Some background on David Wayne as an actor. He joined a Shakespeare repertory company in Cleveland where he worked as a statistician. That word, repertory, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. He was rejected by the Army in World War II, but volunteered to drive an ambulance in North Africa. While he was there, he was actually... this isn't really that funny, but he was mistakenly... listed as killed in action as a mistake. I think it was a clerical error or something. When he came back from driving the ambulance, he saw great success on Broadway. He was actually the first person to receive an acting Tony Award at the first award ceremony in 1947. He won for a role in a play called Finian's Rainbow. In 1954, he won another Tony for his role in The Tea House of the August Moon. And he was nominated in 1968 for Best Actor in a Musical for The Happy Time. So he was a successful actor. That's pretty much all I got on David Wayne. co-starring as the devil is Thomas Gomez. He has an interesting backstory. He stumbled into acting after answering a help wanted ad after high school, and it actually resulted in him joining a theater group, which led to him traveling across the country, kind of honing his acting skills, and which eventually led to him performing in New York's legitimate theater. And what's funny about that is that he just answered the help wanted ad in like 1923, 1927. He had no interest in acting before that, but I guess he kind of caught the bug and, you know, grew from there. His film debut was in 1942's Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror as a villain. He would go on to play a lot more villainous roles, I guess. He was also a union man, a very, very adamant union man. He actually served on the board of directors for the Screen Actors Guild. And while his career had a lot of supporting roles in film, he was really a star on Broadway and had a really fruitful theater career. In 1971, he was in a car accident and passed away after 3 weeks in a coma. Of course, this episode was written by Rod Serling. And what I like to do in this section of the rundown of the talent is kind of try to dissect the theme of the episode or kind of the hidden meanings there. So this one's kind of tough. It's got kind of a clear "be careful what you wish for" theme that kind of goes on. Like, I mean, Baedeker wants immortality, gets immortality, things go awry. But I feel like any deeper meaning would have to reside in Baedeker as a character. He's filled with disdain. It's almost like Serling's script goes out of its way to make you just hate Baedeker because he's so spiteful, he's so hateful, and he's all those things, and then he's also needy. Like, as soon as there's a scene where the doctor leaves, and then Baedeker yells for his wife to come shut the window because it's letting in a draft and it's killing him. And then he scoffs at her and screams at her when he finds out that the doctor wrote a prescription for her when she needs, you know, medicine just to handle taking care of him. So he's just really a just kind of just hateful, kind of despicable character. And I thought that was – I'll get into that in a bit, but – So I think from that it may be a tale about karma. He's a dreadful person who takes an opportunity only to have it ruin him. Although that theory may be negated by how common the deal with the devil plot is. I tried to do some research on this, and the having deals with the devil, I mean, that dates back to late 1800s literature. Or maybe it's that he can't find happiness in his narcissism and his unpleasantness is his downfall. Maybe that's just the theme of it, is that you can't be happy as a narcissist. I don't know if any of this is reflective of Serling as a person at the time. And then again, maybe there is no deeper meaning. If you have one, or if you have thoughts on what Serling could have been saying as a statement in this episode, please, you know, let me know. Email me, tweet me, call and leave a voicemail, and let me know at 317-762-6099. This episode was directed by Mitchell Lyson, who also directed The 16mm Shrine. I think this was the first episode that he directed of the show. I think this was actually the second episode in the production order after The Lonely, which is the episode I'll talk about next week. He has one more episode later this season. That's when I'll kind of get into more detail about him as a director. So finally, we come to my feelings as a viewer on Escape Clause, and I don't know. It's like I said before, and when I was talking about Rod Serling, I hate Walter Baedeker. I really do. And this may be a cautionary tale about narcissism, but I hated the character, which that was somewhat refreshing after finding so many of the other characters so far so relatable and so down to earth and so kind of everyman characters in a way. But I think the dreadfulness of Walter Baedeker kind of just leads this episode to be kind of just an okay episode for me. I appreciated the filmmaking, though. For 1959, Walter's wife's fall looked convincing enough, and the quick cutaway as Walter jumped in front of the train, coupled with the screams and the lighting and the sound of the train, was really effective and very, very surprising. I kind of didn't really see it coming. It was really, It was well done. I'm looking forward to seeing what Lyson does in the last episode that he... Well, I guess that would be the second episode that he directed, because the production order has the 16mm Shrine being his last one, but the last one to air, which I believe will be... I'll be discussing in a few weeks, I think. As I said, I kind of view this episode as just an okay episode, but something that I did find interesting about it is that it's kind of the opposite of One for the Angels, like really, really opposite. If I weren't going chronologically through the Twilight Zone, I probably would have paired these two episodes. In fact, they would really make a good double feature. It's funny, though, how One for the Angels and Escape Clause take different routes to the same end. Like, they're basically polar opposites in terms of characterization and storytelling. One of them, we have Walter is begging the audience to hate him, while Lou Bookman is an endearing old man who loves kids. Walter grows tired of life after thrill-seeking with his immortality, while Lou argues and connives in a pleasant way to gain more time. Walter's cold reaction to the loss of his wife leads him to solitude, while Lou's actions injure a child, which leads him to save her life. What's interesting, though, is that both men's deaths are welcome. Lou ascends peacefully, while Walter gets what's coming to him, really. And I'm really curious if this sort of dichotomy in the storytelling will pop up frequently as I move forward in the Twilight Zone. I'm not sure if it does or not, but it's interesting. Of those two episodes, I find One for the Angels vastly superior. And of these two episodes in this episode of Anthology, I find Walking Distance to be a lot better than this one. There's nothing really wrong with this episode, with Escape Clause per se, but I don't know. It was just okay. So I think that about does it for this week's episode of Anthology. Thank you for joining me for this week's discussion of Walking Distance and Escape Clause. If you have any thoughts on the episodes or about the podcast as a whole, please get in contact with me. You know where to find me. I'll have it in the show notes and also in the pre-recorded outro that's about to play. Both episodes were pretty solid this week. I really liked Walking Distance, and I'm looking forward to next week. Next week is actually a really big episode. I'll be discussing episodes 7 and 8 of The Twilight Zone Season 1. On one hand, The Lonely is a haunting tale of love and isolation, and on the other hand, Time Enough at Last is perhaps The Twilight Zone's most iconic episode ever. Join me next week, and until then, thank you for listening to Anthology. Thank you for listening to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. You can find past episodes of the show at AnthologyPod.com, and please subscribe on iTunes and leave a rating and review. It helps the show out more than you might think. Of course, I crave feedback or conversation of any kind from the audience, so please email your thoughts and feelings about the show to Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com. Or you can tweet me @ObsessiveViewer and make sure you like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. Of course, you can also leave me a voicemail at 317-762-6099 for a chance to have it played on the show. If you like what you've heard here, I urge you to check out The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast I host with my friends Tiny and Mike. Also check out the Obsessive Viewer blog at ObsessiveViewer.com, where I write movie reviews, TV reviews, and the occasional editorial about the business of entertainment. You can find all of that at ObsessiveViewer.com. If you want even more obsessive content in your life, subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer subreddit at r/ObsessiveViewer. And check out ObsessiveBookNerd.com for book reviews, author spotlights, and a general celebration of reading. Finally, if you're philosophically curious, check out my friend Tiny's side project podcast, The Secular Perspective, which explores the concepts of faith, religion, and existence from the perspective of secular hosts. You can find that at thesecularperspective.com. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Join the Obsessive Viewer podcast on October 16th, 2015 at the Irving Theater in Indianapolis for The Obsessive Viewer Presents Shocktober in Irvington Part 2. It's a one-night event screening of short horror films from local artists J.P. Leck and Snapshot Productions. There will be giveaways, raffles, interviews with the filmmakers, and so much more. All proceeds will go directly to the Irvington Historical Society. Go to shocktoberinirvington.com for more details, and prepare to be shocked.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 U.S.-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out Pear.com today to learn more. That's P-A-I-R.com.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.